Good afternoon. I am Dr. Bill Muth. I am here today to discuss the approach to the patient with Staphylococcus bacteremia. I'm very happy to not be talking about H1N1 flu for a change. Instead, I'll be talking about this topic, which is very important. It represents a scenario that we are often confronting when we are caring for patients in the hospital. Here is a picture that shows you the organism we're talking about. On the left is an electron micrograph that's colorized to show you the grape-like clusters that Staphylococci have, and thus the Greek root giving it the name Staphylococcus. On the right is how the organism appears when it grows on blood agar with a gold color, and thus the name aureus. Today the objectives are to understand the importance of Staphylococcus aureus infections, their diverse natures, and the organism's inherent virulence, to understand how to distinguish between Staph aureus bacteremia and endocarditis, to understand when to use echocardiography in evaluating Staphylococcus aureus bacteremia, to understand currently available antibiotic therapies of Staph aureus bacteremia, and to understand the appropriate duration of therapy for Staphylococcus bacteremia endocarditis. Well, why is it important to understand about Staphylococcus bacteremia? Well, there are several reasons. One, it is common. Two, the organism is virulent. Three, the organism can be multi-drug resistant. Four, Staph aureus can have all sorts of endovascular and metastatic complications when it causes bacteremic illness. So we'll talk about these things. How common is it? Well, it's becoming increasingly common. The data that I cite on this slide are a bit old, but you can see that in the 10-year period in the 1980s, the incidence of Staph aureus bacteremia went up by almost 300% in non-teaching hospitals that reported to the National Nosocomial Infection Survey, and by about 176% in large teaching hospitals that also so reported. By 1998, Staph aureus had become the second most common bloodstream isolate. And why is this occurring? Well, it's because of medical interventions. We are increasingly placing prosthetic materials in patients, including intravenous catheters, and giving the opportunity for Staph aureus to cause problems. Looking at all causes of infection, not just bacteremic infections, but infections in general, Staph aureus is a very common pathogen. There are two graphs on this slide. The uppermost shows inpatient causes of infection. The lowermost one shows outpatient causes of infection. In a survey of 3 million clinical isolates from hospitals in the United States from 1988 to 2005, you can see these are the data, with Staph aureus being the most common in the inpatients and the second most common in outpatients. It is a very resourceful and virulent organism. It produces proteins or molecules that are very numerous, that have a variety of means of contributing to pathogenesis. This table shows a partial list, which is completed in the next slide, where additional proteins or molecules are listed that contribute to the disease that Staph aureus can cause. And basically, the pathogenesis involves these means in which the organism affects its nasty work: adhesion and colonization, tissue invasion via exfoliative toxins, hemolysins, and so forth, the ability to evade the immune system. The organism can evade phagocytosis, or it can actually lyse leukocytes, neutrophils, in those strains that contain the Pantan-Valentine leukocidin. Also, Staph aureus can produce biofilms, and these films allow organisms to exist in a stationary phase in such a fashion that some antibiotics have no effect. Staph aureus can upregulate the production of these various factors in the setting of immune response or antibiotic exposure. Staph aureus is increasingly multi-drug resistant. A commonly cited figure is 60% of Staph aureus isolates are now methicillin resistant, as reported to the National Nosocomial Infection Survey. These are ICU isolates. Also, there have been rarely cases of vancomycin intermediate and vancomycin resistant strains of Staphylococcus aureus. This is a table from the Mandel textbook of medicine, which talks about all the different means of resistance that this bacterium has to a variety of antibiotics. The only reason this table isn't larger with newer antibiotics is because it's a table that's a bit dated. Staph aureus can have protean, endovascular, and distant complications. Endocarditis is going to be a focus of my talk. It is one of the endovascular complications. It's increasing. Most cases remain community-acquired, but healthcare-associated cases due to the increasing prevalence of implantable devices and interventional procedures are increasing. There are common metastatic foci of infection, including septic arthritis, hematogenous osteomyelitis, vertebral osteomyelitis, and so forth. This following slide, therefore, just talks about how Staph aureus can cause infection virtually anywhere. Skin and soft tissue infection is common in the forms of impetigo, cellulitis, necrotizing fasciitis, and furuncles and carbuncles. Bone and joint infection, we've already mentioned, in forms of septic arthritis of joint prostheses, of osteomyelitis, either hematogenous in children or contiguous in adults, bacteremia and infective endocarditis we've been talking about, pneumonia, nosocomial pneumonia, and community-acquired pneumonia. The community-associated strains of MRSA, for example, are known to cause a necrotizing, aggressive form of pneumonia. There are toxigenic syndromes, including staphylococcal food poisoning, toxic shock, and scalded skin syndromes, and finally, deep space infection. In addition to those which I've already mentioned, such as in the liver abscess, splenic abscess, pyomyositis, and of course, surgical site infection, where this organism plays a very primary role. I think it's interesting to think about Staph aureus in the great scheme of things, and here's a scattergram that I've created, my own creation, I should say. On the y-axis is the nastiness scale. On the x-axis is the occurrence or frequency scale. There are a number of organisms that are very, very nasty, but fortunately don't occur frequently. Things like Ebola virus, anthrax, and plague. You could add other things to that list. On the other hand, there are other infectious diseases that are very common but aren't particularly morbid, such as rhinovirus and seasonal influenza. Staphylococcus aureus, on the other hand, occupies a pretty unique place in that it is both common and virulent, and thus I think it's an organism that we must respect. Okay, I'm going to have you participate and answer a couple cases. I'm not going to tell you my answers, but we'll give you the opportunity give me yours. The first case is a 45-year-old white female with Crohn's disease in the hospital receiving TPN via central line becomes acutely febrile. Blood cultures 12 hours later are reportedly positive for methicillin-sensitive Staphylococcus aureus. She promptly becomes afebrile after IV antibiotics are begun and the line removed. Repeat blood cultures are negative. Questions. What is the antibiotic of choice? How long should she be treated with IV antibiotics? Does she need an echocardiogram to rule out infective endocarditis? If so, what type? TTE, that is transthoracic echocardiogram, versus TEE, transesophageal echocardiogram. Case number two, 75-year-old white female, previously healthy, admitted to the hospital with a 3-day history of shaking, chills, and fever without otherwise localizing findings. Blood cultures 12 hours later are reportedly positive for methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus. Despite prompt initiation of IV napsilin, blood cultures on day 3 and 5 of her hospitalization remain positive. Again, what is the antibiotic of choice? How long should she be treated with IV antibiotics? Does she need an echocardiogram to rule out infective endocarditis? If so, what type? TTE versus TEE. So again, the focus is on bacteremia with Staph aureus. I'd like to talk just briefly about obtaining blood culture so that we can have the opportunity to try to understand the nature of Staph aureus bacteremia. It's important to do it in the correct way. The most important thing is do cultures before antibiotics. If you provide antibiotics first, you may obscure cultures that would otherwise be positive. You want to make sure the skin antisepsis is proper, and you want to do more than one blood culture for several reasons. One, if you do just one, you have less chance of finding the infecting microorganism. Two, if you do just one, you won't demonstrate a continuous bacteremia. Demonstration of a continuous bacteremia is very important in suggesting the presence of an endovascular infection such as endocarditis. And you can't distinguish contaminated cultures from true bacteremias. In other words, if you get just one organism, you don't know for sure whether this is a bacteremic illness or a contaminant. And this, of course, particularly applies to blood cultures that grow coagulase-negative Staph. The optimal number and volume of blood cultures is not known, but 3 cultures may be each 20 cc's in volume may be ideal in adults. Optimal timing really depends on the circumstance, and this is sort of a common sense thing. If you have a patient that is acutely ill and deteriorating in front of you, you don't want to postpone antibiotics for several hours while you space your blood culture draws. So you can do them every 5 minutes till you get your 3 cultures. On the other hand, if you have a subacute illness where the patient is stable, it is okay to do cultures over several hours. Peripheral venipuncture is preferred. This avoids the issue of contaminated line cultures. On the other hand, in some cases and in some institutions, it is desired to know whether the line itself is the cause of the infection, and in those cases, quantitative cultures are done if the colony-forming units are a multiple of 5 or 10 times from the catheter versus the periphery. That might suggest that the catheter is the source of the bacteremic illness. Types of bacteremia, this is an important concept. There are transient bacteremias. These are often asymptomatic and likely occur in all of us when we brush our teeth, floss our teeth, go to the dentist, and so forth. There are intermittent bacteremias, meaning not all the blood cultures are positive, but several of them will be over a period of time. This may represent infection due to a deep space abscess, for example. And then there's persistent sustained bacteremia where virtually all the blood cultures are positive. This suggests an endovascular infection, as an endocarditis or an infected vascular graft, and so forth. Well, I've mentioned that infective endocarditis will be a important focus of this talk, and it is difficult sometimes to know when you have a Staph aureus bacteremia whether the patient may or may not have infective endocarditis, or for that matter, any other complicating site of infection. Here are pictures of endocarditis There is a picture of a vegetation on a valve, and then there is a picture of some peripheral stigmata on a patient's hand of infective endocarditis. So how do you distinguish these entities, that is, a simple Staph aureus bacteremia from endocarditis? Well, there are some clues clinically, and here's a list of several series published in the literature in which investigators have tried to suggest risk factors, and many of them have common features in these various series. In the following slide, I summarize what these are. They include the Oslurian physical findings. These are things such as the Janeway lesions, Roth spots, and Osler nodes, for example. These are not common anymore. Persons with cardiac valvular disease, persons with prosthetic implants, particularly endovascular implants, community-acquired bacteremia, older age, persistent bacteremia, and injection drug use. Unfortunately, these factors aren't by themselves going to identify all cases of Staph aureus. They are not sufficiently sensitive or specific. How do you diagnose infective endocarditis? Well, the means of diagnosis that are commonly used are the modified Duke's criteria. And there are both pathologic and clinical means of making the diagnosis. The pathologic diagnosis is made at autopsy, but of course that's not where you want to go. Also, a pathologic diagnosis can be made when the valve is resected in the process of valve replacement surgery, often when you've previously suspected endocarditis, or if you resect from the periphery an embolism from infected heart valve. Most typically, we're dealing with clinical criteria for endocarditis. According to the Duke criteria, there are two major criteria that are sufficient to make the diagnosis, one major criteria and three minor criteria, or five minor criteria. And I'm going to talk, for sake of brevity, just about the major criteria today. They are in two categories, the microbiologic diagnosis and the echocardiographic findings. The microbiologic diagnosis basically involve two or more positive blood cultures for organisms that are adept at causing endocarditis, and these include Viridin streptococci, Streptococcus bovis, the Hasek group of microorganisms, Staph aureus, or community-acquired enterococci in the absence of a primary focus. I bring to your attention that the authors of this table from Circulation 2005 put Staph aureus emboldened, which indicates, again, the rather unique aspect of this organism to cause endocarditis. Also, other organisms that are not typical cause of endocarditis can fulfill this criterion of major criteria if there are three or more bacteria found three or more cultures found of these organisms, and there is the second major criterion of endocardial involvement based on echocardiography. So the clinical diagnosis requires the appropriate microbiology in the form of blood cultures and the echocardiographic findings suggestive of a valvular vegetation. Okay, so an echocardiogram is important in the clinical diagnosis of endocarditis. Which echocardiogram do you do? And here's a scheme published in Circulation in 1998 that helps tries to provide guidance in that category. And they suggest doing an initial TEE if there's high initial patient risk, moderate to high clinical suspicion, or difficulty imaging the candidate. Usually that means obesity in terms of the TTE not being able to give good windows of visualization of the heart. And the authors suggest high initial patient risk would include prosthetic heart valves, many congenital heart diseases, previous endocarditis, new murmur, heart failure, or other stigmata of endocarditis. So these are the high initial patient risk from a cardiac standpoint. On top of that, as I mentioned before, there are the high clinical suspicions, and that would, in terms of Staph aureus, include those features which I've already mentioned. So to a significant extent, many authorities would argue that Staph aureus, because of its propensity to cause endocarditis, may be a bacteremic illness that should have TEE primarily to evaluate it. The Infectious Disease Society of America is one such organization. They talk about the approach to Staph aureus bacteremia complicating central lines, and in essence they say if not contraindicated, TEE should be done to rule out vegetation in persons with catheter-related Staph aureus bloodstream infection. It is known that TEE is more sensitive than TTE, but invasive and costly. It's definitely indicated in persons with prosthetic heart valves. The TEE has an excellent negative predictive value. The guidelines I just showed you were from 2001. The IDSA has just updated its guidelines, and again, they say TEE is important, and in this case, they say it's important if you want to treat a patient for endocarditis. Sorry, if you want to treat a patient for Staph aureus bacteremia for a duration shorter than 4 weeks. Okay, I want to talk about antibiotic therapy. Staph aureus bacteremia endocarditis. And I mentioned to you it's important to think about source control because the antibiotics will not necessarily cure your patient if there's an abscess that needs drained and so forth. So it's important to seek sites of infection. It's not infrequent that such a site is not discovered, I must say. Antibiotic therapy for Staph aureus is methicillin sensitive. Drug of choice, nafcillin or oxacillin. First generation cephalosporins such as cefazolin are alternatives for persons with penicillin allergy. Vancomycin used for persons with severe penicillin allergy. Clindamycin should generally be avoided because it's a static drug and may not be effective for bloodstream infection. How about for Staph aureus endocarditis native valve? Well, the American Heart Association and the IDSA have published guidelines. This is a very detailed table. But again, for endocarditis native valve, nafcillin or oxacillin is a drug of choice, and they recommend a 6-week duration. Cefazolin is an alternative for penicillin allergic patients, and vancomycin for oxacillin-resistant strains, or those with severe anaphylactic type reactions to penicillin. For MRSA, vancomycin is the drug of choice. I will mention to you that the use of aminoglycosides for native valve endocarditis its benefit has not been established, and increasingly it is not being utilized for native valve endocarditis. For prosthetic valve endocarditis, a much more difficult infection to treat, nafcillin or oxacillin is the drug of choice, plus rifampin, plus gentamicin for oxacillin susceptible strains. For methicillin-resistant strains, vancomycin plus rifampin and gentamicin are recommended. Duration for greater than or equal to 6 weeks. endocarditis indications for surgery. This is a bit of an aside. The indications are listed in this table. I put this slide up there primarily to also mention that Staph aureus itself is a relative indication for valve replacement, as are all cases of prosthetic valve endocarditis. How long should therapy be for Staph aureus bacteremia, not endocarditis? For simple bacteremia, that is, one that has negative transesophageal echocardiogram, therapy can be as short as 2 weeks. For uncomplicated Staph aureus bacteremia, no TEE performed, 4 weeks is a reasonable length of time. For complicated Staph aureus bacteremia, 4 to 6 weeks, along with source control. What is this idea of simple bacteremia? Well, I'm sort of belaboring this point, and in fact, simple bacteremia in many respects is the converse of the complicated bacteremia with the risk factors that we previously discussed. If there's a catheter, it will be removed. Blood cultures that follow up are negative. The patient defervesces within 72 hours. The patient has a negative transesophageal echocardiogram. He has no prosthetic material in the joints or intravascular space, and no symptom suggestive of metastatic infection. Dr. Fowler at Duke looked at complicated Staph aureus bacteremia and risk according to a scoring system, tried to predict who would likely have a complication, and he found when he gave 1 point for community acquisition of infection, 1 point for the skin finding suggestive of systemic infection, 1 point for persistent fever at 72 hours, and 2 points for a positive blood culture at 48 to 96 hours, he was able to predict a complicated bacteremia in a fashion as illustrated in this table, where someone with score 0 had only a 16% likelihood of complicated bacteremia, whereas one with a score of 5 had a 90% complication of bacteremia. So this is a scheme that could be used to help determine how aggressive one needs to be with both antibiotic duration, echocardiography, etc. What about therapy for MRSA bacteremia? Vancomycin is generally the drug of choice. It has slower cytal activity as compared to the beta-lactam antibiotics. There are heterogeneous strains that may have some varying susceptibility. There has been a phenomenon of, quote, MIC creep, end quote, where the MICs have been gradually rising to vancomycin. Daptomycin is an excellent drug for MRSA bacteremia. You need to avoid, however, using it in MRSA pneumonia because it does not work in that disease. It is said to be inactivated by pulmonary surfactant. Linezolid is an excellent anti-staphylococcal drug and effective for MRSA, but it would be wise to avoid it in bacteremic illness because there have been failures, perhaps because it's a static drug. Tigecycline is a good drug for MRSA in skin and soft tissue infection and intra-abdominal infection, but it has low serum levels and may not be effective for bacteremic illness. So I'm back to the first case. What antibiotic of choice would you use for this person with Crohn's disease whose line is removed and she rapidly defervesces? I would use naphsone. How long would I treat her? Well, that depends on an echocardiogram. If she had a TEE and it was negative for 2 weeks, otherwise at least 4 weeks. Does she need an echocardiogram to rule out infective endocarditis? I think, given the information that I've provided you, wherein we know that Staph aureus is quite capable of causing infection even in seemingly innocuous circumstances. If you recall that 16% figure of complicated infection when in the Fowler scheme score zero, I would still tend to favor transesophageal echocardiogram just to make sure there's no endocarditis and to give myself the possibility of being comfortable treating her with a short course. Case number two, which is a more complicated case, someone who became ill in the outpatient realm, was sick for a while, remained sick even on naphcillin. I think naphcillin is still the drug of choice because we know it's the most effective Staph aureus drug. I think there's a focus of infection that needs further attention somewhere in this individual. How long should she be treated? Well, at least 4 to 6 weeks. And it depends upon this issue of source control. And she needs an echocardiogram. She needs a TEE, I think, because of the complicated nature of her illness. She has several clinical risks, outpatient acquisition of infection, persistent bacteremia, persistent fever. Well, actually, I guess I did not say that she had persistent fever, but in any event, she does have risk for endocarditis. So in general, I would like you to understand just the aggressive nature of Staph aureus, the fact that Staph aureus bacteremia is common, the fact that it is difficult to distinguish patients that may or may not have endocarditis or other complicated infections. I think it's very important to treat this organism with great respect and to use echocardiography. At minimum, transthoracic, but probably where it's available, more appropriately, transesophageal echocardiography in the evaluation of these patients. I thank you for your attention.